Hi there, welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 265. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and I am exhausted. But I am very much looking forward to another rousing round of Radio Free Nintendo with my buddies, Greg Leahy.
Hello.
James Jones.
What's up, Count Von Suckenstein?
And John Lindemann.
Hey, how's it going, Johnny?
Jesus.
It's going great. And
sorry, I didn't use something like Suckenstein, James.
I thought this week maybe we could have a nice in-depth discussion on the 15th anniversary of the Nintendo 64.
Oh, you'll be leaving? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, I thought I got away relatively scot-free after all the build-up, and I'm very glad you guys got to do that episode, and I enjoyed listening to it. So, good job.
We still hate you, just to be clear.
Now we move on with a more traditional episode. We've got new business and actually some really interesting games and a concert report coming up in new business. And then after the break and now playing, we're going to have your listener mail, and we have some very interesting, fun emails to discuss on this episode. At the end of the show, we're going to have an update on the live telethon event that we did last year, and it is coming back, and we have the first details on that for you. By the way, I should say at the outset of the show that we're not doing retroactive this week. That will be next week. So River City Ransom, if you have not started playing it yet, you've got plenty of time. It is $5. $5, man, on Virtual Console, all over the place. It's very easy to get. It's a really cool, interesting little game. It won't take you a ton of time to play through. And I think there's some good discussion going on in the forum threads. So more on that later. First up, though, we got new business, and I'll kick it off since I've had a couple weeks off. And I did want to talk about Kirby Mass Attack. Now, maybe our negligence of this character will come up a little bit later in the show, but I do like Kirby, and I do like his games, and I was pretty interested in Kirby Mass Attack since I read the reviews and I heard a lot of praise for it from various people whose opinions I respect. And I heard it compared to Pikmin, which I love. And I heard it compared to Canvas Curse, which is the first great DS game, really. I think pretty much everyone agrees who's played it. I haven't played Canvas Curse in about 5 years, so I don't know if it holds up. I don't know if it's still as interesting as it was at the time. It was such a... I mean, I feel like, you know, in 2005, when I first played it, probably, I think I imported it even, but it was such a breath of fresh air because it was a real game for the DS. Mm-hmm. And it was really, that system really seemed to be lacking anything other than minigame compilations. Where have you heard this before? So it was really refreshing and a very well put together game. Not my favorite Kirby game ever. Not my favorite game ever, but I loved it. And, you know, I was kind of hoping for more stuff like that. And we sort of did from various other franchises. But, you know, after maybe one or two sort of disappointing adventures on the DS, Kirby gives his swan song here with Mass Attack. And it is a very, very good game. It's not going to be my DS game of the year or anything like that, but I've had a lot of fun with it, and I think it's right up there with Canvas Curse in terms of being very creative, very out of the box, and also not really a Kirby game in the mechanical sense. I mean, certainly it has the presentation of Kirby, and it has that charm, and it has the music and the, you know, the colorful graphics and everything. And all that is a big part of the experience. But in terms of the way that you play the game, it really doesn't have a whole lot to do with Kirby. I mean, you don't inhale enemies. You don't absorb their powers. And even in Canvas Curse, you did that. You absorb their powers a little bit, but not at all in Mass Attack. The idea is that Kirby has been divided up into 10 pieces of himself, basically. They all look like Kirby, but they don't really have his full power. They're kind of weak on their own, and they're only really effective when they gang up and sort of work together. And so it provides this interesting progression, because every time you get to a new world, you know, after a set of 7 or 8 smaller levels, you go to a new world, and it always resets you to one Kirby. And the Kirbys are persistent between the individual levels. So you do kind of build up over time. As you eat more fruit, you create new Kirbys up to a limit of 10. And when you have 10 Kirbys, you're very powerful. And you can do, I mean, there aren't many enemies who can really stand up to you when you have 10 Kirbys. And they can be killed and you can get reduced down to a lower number. But that really doesn't seem to happen a whole lot. And I don't think I'm particularly skilled at the game. So I think it's just, you know, it's on the easy side as you would expect from the franchise. But when you have 10 Kirbys, you're pretty powerful, and that, you know, could run the risk of becoming boring after a while. So I think it's really clever that they knock you back down to 1, and it also means that at least for the first 2 or 3 levels of each world, they can sort of count on you not having a full complement of Kirbys, which means they can put in a lot of secrets that you're going to have to come back to later with more Kirbys in order to complete. They can put in enemies who would be kind of a joke later on, but because you've only got 1 or 2 Kirbys, they actually can be very difficult and sort of time-consuming to kill. And, you know, when you're in this diminished state of only having a couple of them, if you lose one, that's a really big deal. And if you get hit, then you're not going to have many chances to recover. So it's very cleverly done. It is really fun. It's actually almost challenging when you only have a few Kirbys. And then once you have a lot, it's not really challenging anymore, but it's very empowering and satisfying to play because you are quite powerful. And for me, the only problem really is in the controls, which you probably could have guessed because you are controlling 10 characters with one single point touch input, which is not a whole lot. You know, I mean, on Pikmin, you control a lot of characters, but you also have a lot of buttons and 2 joysticks and shoulder buttons and a lot of means to corral them around and to sort them and to do different things. And in Mass Attack, one of the problems is that it's difficult to use one Kirby, or it's difficult. Actually, the biggest problem is you can always flick one Kirby at a time. And unfortunately, you usually have to do that repetitively to sort of flick a lot of them. So it's a very repetitive motion that you have to do. But the big problem for me is that you can't really separate your Kirbys into 2 or 3 groups and control them separately. There's no way to do that. And that, you know, like in Pikmin, that's a really interesting part of the game, especially in Pikmin 2, is dividing your troops up into multiple squadrons and then sending them out and maybe attacking an enemy from 2 different sides or coordinating on a puzzle where you really have to have 2 different groups in order to do something together. You can't really do that kind of level of sophistication in the Kirby Mass Attack design, because if you just tap anywhere, all the Kirbys will go to that point. And if you hold down anywhere, all the Kirbys will coalesce, and then you can draw a line to make them sort of float together. So most of your inputs involve making all the Kirbys gather, and that means that it's actually kind of impossible to control groups of them separately. And I think that's a shame. I wish you could maybe hold down a shoulder button to disable that gathering ability so that you can actually control them separately and do interesting things, you know, put them on parallel paths or make them hit switches at the same time, that kind of stuff. You can't really do that, unfortunately, with this interface. So I think the game is not as deep as it could have been, but it's certainly very fun. And, you know, if you like Kirby, or if you just like these kind of experimental Kirby games that they put out every few years, I think you can't go wrong with it. It's really good.
Now, the one thing I observed just from playing the demo at the London E3 event is it seemed to have quite a sort of Yoshi's Island thing going on in that, you know, it seemed like it'd be pretty easy to get through just from A to B, but there's a lot of stuff hidden and all that. And I get the rub with that sort of thing is, what do you get for it? So do you kind of have a sense yet of all what those like rewards that you accrue from getting all this secret stuff?
Yeah, it's a good question, because there is a system of rewards. Actually, there's a list of achievements, which is one thing, and I don't think there's really any reward for getting the achievements. It's just, you know, checking off a list. So if you're kind of a completionist, you can do that. The problem is they don't tell you what they are ahead of time, so there's not really any way to go out and seek those. You just kind of may or may not activate them in the course of playing the game. But there's also a list of unlockable rewards, and those are unlocked by collecting medals. And there are, I think there are 3 to 5 medals in every level. And some of them are very challenging to get. They take a lot of skill, or they take some kind of foreknowledge of the level. You know, like you would have had to play through it at least 2 or 3 times before you really know where to get them. And some of them involved completing little challenges, you know, defeating extra enemies or just taking a more difficult path. So all that, you know, I like, and they unlock the mini games for the most part. There's also like a sound test a couple other little things. But for the most part, they unlock minigames, which are, you know, a hallmark of the Kirby franchise. And the minigames are pretty interesting, actually. They're worth unlocking. The problem is that in the course of just playing through the levels the first time, you will probably get enough medals to unlock everything. From what I've seen so far, I haven't unlocked the last couple of items, so maybe those you really have to be hardcore and go back and actually, you know, purposefully collect things in order to unlock those, and I don't know if they would be worth the effort, but 80-90% of the rewards you're going to unlock just by beating the game, so not surprising again for me. But just to get on the minigames for a quick second, I mean, there are a couple of them that are absurdly simple and shallow and not much fun. Like, you know, we're talking like probably less complex than a Game & Watch game. So those are not going to hold your interest for more than a couple of minutes, most likely. But then there are also a couple of really, really cool ones. There's a pinball game that, as far as I can tell, is pretty complex. I think it has one main table, but also like four boss type, you know, like side tables that you can get warped to, and each one has a boss that you have to defeat and then go back to the main table and try to move on to the next one. And to do that would be quite challenging, actually. And it has pretty good physics and just a lot going on. And that's really fun. Although it's a bit odd controlling a pinball game with a touchscreen.
Oh.
It works. It's not quite as reactive as I would like with a button press, but it works okay, actually. And it looks really good. And it's very, very impressively done for, you know, kind of a throwaway bonus thing that a lot of people probably won't even mess with. It's really well done. But the other thing, and I really wanted to talk about this on the show because I know you guys will be interested in it. There is a vertical shoot 'em up minigame that you can unlock that is a surprisingly full-featured, almost full-length vertical shoot 'em up. Like, I think 6 or 7 levels. I think the whole thing took me probably 20 or 30 minutes to play through.
Wow.
And it's really fun and really, really interesting in the way it's set up because it actually reminded me of Shoot 1 Up, the Mommy's Best Game thing that we talked about, which is coming to, what, Windows 7 phone? Is that right, John?
Yep. It's coming, I think, in January.
In January. Okay. Hopefully to iPhone as well, because I also got one of those recently.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so this Kirby game, it's called like Strato Defenders or something like that. It's a weird name that it has. But it is a shoot 'em up that you control the touchscreen. Kirby automatically shoots, I believe, and you just point where you want him to go. And the cool thing is it has the same multiple Kirby motif as the main game. So as you get certain power-ups, as you play through the shoot-em-up, you add Kirbys, and they sort of trail around. You know, like a mouse trail, you know, like on a cursor on Windows?
Mm-hmm.
You point where you want it to go, and the leading Kirby will go there almost immediately. But the more Kirbys you have, the more lag there is on the last ones catching up to that. So as the levels become more complex, you've got bullet patterns coming down, you've got spikes and, you know, all kinds of obstacles that you're trying to avoid, it becomes really interesting trying to lead this trail of Kirbys that you have through there. And then also, there's a certain advantage into, if you do it right, you can sort of make them dispersed, you know, so that they're all shooting and you have this big spread of shots. But of course, that also makes them a lot more exposed to enemy fire, and it makes it easier to lose one of them if they get hit, which is very much just like Shoot 1 Up. So it's really, really cool and very fun. And like I said, surprisingly substantive for a Kirby minigame. So I really like that. And, you know, the amount of fun that I had with that and the pinball game does make me really want to see what the last couple rewards are. Because if there's anything else on that order, then I think it would be worth whatever effort it took to go get more medals. All right, well, the other game that I have this week is a real quick one, but I did play a round of Tiger Woods 12 The Masters with my dad when I was traveling last week.
Awesome.
It was a pretty cool experience, and it put me in this really strange position of my dad showing me a game that I had never played before.
What was he good at it though?
He's pretty good at it, although he plays with some of the assists, you know, he didn't have all of the Motion Plus stuff turned on. And when I turned it on, I was like, well, I'm going to turn this stuff on because, you know, I'm not going to play this very often. I kind of want to see how accurate it is or how nasty it is with your swing. And it's pretty nasty. I mean, I was horrible. I was shooting like quadruple bogeys and stuff like that, which is very realistic for real golf when I do occasionally play real golf. And Dad was probably a little bit better than me for the most part, even with that stuff turned on. But I could tell that he was getting a little bit frustrated because he was used to it being more forgiving, you know, when he plays it on the lower settings or on the less accurate settings, especially with the precision putting. And I wish we had watched a tutorial on what that actually means, because the interface of this sort of power bar with showing your backswing and your front swing on the putt didn't make a lot of sense to me. I wasn't really sure what I was supposed to be doing with that bar. And the precision putting was very, very difficult to nail. And at one point, actually, the funniest thing that happened is my dad ended up with a putt that was like less than a foot away from the hole. I mean, this is just a tap in, you know, I mean, even in real golf, this is a really easy shot. Well, on the standard putting that he's used to using, you can just haphazardly just basically waggle, you know, and it'll go in. So he basically just swung the remote pretty hard, which he's used to working just fine for him. But on precision putting, it picked it up as a really super powerful putt, and his putt was so hard that the ball actually jumped over the hole like in a trick pool shot, and it rolled like 20 yards across on the other side of it. So it ended up adding like three strokes on the hole for him, and that was a real rude awakening for him on just how much more precise the precision putting is. But we had a good time with it. It's not really my cup of tea, and it's not a game I would run out and buy just because I think realistic golf games are a bit boring. Maybe the RPG stuff could pull me in after a while, but I find real golf to be kind of exhausting after about the first 7 or 8 holes. I usually by the time I get to the back 9, I'm kind of done with it, and I don't really want to be there anymore. It's just that I find it to be very repetitive, and this is not a game I would buy, but Dad loves it, and you know, I'm very happy that he found a Wii game that he likes.
Cool, very cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. All right, so James, you're up next.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure I promised this game last week, so nobody should be particularly surprised that my game for this week is the latest Layton title, the fourth one. Depending on what region you're in, something about Spectres and something else.
It's Last Spectre in the States, and then Spectre's Call, I think, is in Europe.
Yeah, so this is Last Spectre. Yes, you're right. So this game is pretty much just a Layton game in its core. So if you're in Europe, it is just a Layton game. but the primary difference being that it's earlier than all the previous Layton games. It's how Layton met Luke, which means it's just before the movie, which I saw a while ago, but it kind of helps the movie make a little bit more sense now.
Does it follow the same general story arc as when Harry met Sally?
No, not in the slightest. What I will say is that because everyone's a little bit younger, they are a little bit different character-wise, but it's not a huge difference. Luke is a bit more... First off, Luke's voice is kind of deeper, which is weird, because he's younger. Not greatly deeper, just a little bit deeper. And he's much less concerned with being gentlemanly and much less mature, so he's a much better character, to be honest. He's kind of troublemaking, which I find to make the story more amusing.
Is he turned into Scrappy Doo?
No, thank God, no.
Well, let me add him. I'll splat him.
He's still very mature for his age, but relatively speaking, he's...
Scrappy Doo, the worst character ever, by the way.
No, the Scooby-Doo cousin was worse, to be honest.
oh, God, I forgot about him.
But anyway, Layton. For whatever reason, this game doesn't feel quite as good as the last game. I would put it somewhere between the first game and the second in terms of quality. So for me, up until now, it's been a steady progression in quality. So I'm actually dropping it back about 2 games. But it's still a good game. I still really enjoy it. The puzzles don't feel quite as difficult as they have in the past, but I think I said that last time too. So maybe it's just a point of I just kind of know how these games go, and I can just hammer through these puzzles.
I think you've peeked behind the curtain, James. I think you've played them so much that you just kind of... It's going to be hard for them to surprise you.
Yeah, I mean, I did beat the game in 13 hours in 2 days, starting on the first day in the afternoon. So it was kind of, like I said, I still have a problem. It's just probably not as bad a problem as before. What I found is the story is actually marginally less psychotic than the last 3 games. marginally, because if it was any other series, it would still be psychotic. But it's closer to being feasible in that it doesn't make me just want to throw the DS at the ground and go, no, that didn't just happen. But the real story here is London life, either that it's inclusion or exclusion, depending on where you are. London life is this kind of weird extra thing we've talked about on the show that, for whatever reason, Level 5 just tacked on to the fourth Layton game when it was released in Japan. And it's essentially a opportunity to explore a place called Little London as a character of your own creation and accomplish quests for people in town, which are essentially just minor characters from the Layton series. So all four games up to that point are represented in it by their various obnoxious, potentially dangerous individuals. And you just get to sort of walk around and get very character-related quests for them and complete them and then turn that into money and, quote, happiness, which is the primary method of which your skills are judged and how much you are paid. So, for whatever reason, the concept of the game is to make everybody happy, and that means you get paid more. That's basically the premise of the game.
Do you run into adult Luke?
No, I don't think I've run into adult Luke yet. I haven't run into child Luke either, actually, but I've run into Layton. I've run into a bunch of the other recurring characters.
So who are you playing as, if not Layton or Luke?
You are a character of your own creation that you build through the character creator, which lets you pick, you know, a body, a face, hair. So right now I have a permanent scowl and a pompadour.
Unsurprisingly.
Then you get to pick clothes, which range from being like 10 wealth, because the game's currency is actually wealth. It's called wealth, to 1 million wealth for a crown that you can buy. And these affect your coolness stat, your how much of an impression you make on people when they see you, and your it's not classiness, but it's essentially a synonym for being classy. And those stats will affect A, people who see you, and B, if you're be allowed into more classy establishments. Presumably, if you're wearing a crown, you can get in wherever you want. So right now, I'm wearing a gold top hat, a tuxedo with tails, black dress pants, and a fishing vest, because that's how I roll. And I'm a widely respected gentleman in zebra gloves.
It definitely sounds like if you pick out the correct items, you could probably create Henry Hatsworth.
Possibly.
That's like Johnny's
a golden top hat and a cane.
There are quite a lot of items.
The giant mech every now and again.
Yeah,
there we go.
Yeah.
The zebra gloves right now are my favorite element of my outfit.
You realize if you go around Little London, you have to call them zebra gloves.
I might not, because they constantly make jokes about the fact that this is supposed to be England, even though you're probably American playing this.
You know what would be awesome is a Professor Layton 2D action platformer created by the Henry Hatsworth guys.
I don't know if they can take the right level of weird that would require.
Oh yes, they could.
It's where Layton uses Luke in a way analogous to Peach using Toad in Smash Brothers, like just plucks him out from somewhere and uses him as a human shield as his arms and legs flail in desperation.
Jeez. This would be a great companion to the next Professor Layton crossover, which I think we've already correctly established should be Professor Layton and Scooby-Doo.
No.
Yeah, oh, that is a natural fit, to be fair.
Yeah.
Oh, it makes me want to take poison. What I find actually most interesting about this game isn't the Animal Crossing kind of stuff, you know, getting clothes, getting apartment decorations, making the right impression on people, you know, getting people's little fetch quests. What is most interesting about the game, to me at least, is the fact that all of these Layton characters, which are really eccentric, but because they're, you know, one character out of 30 in the original game they're in, their characters never really expanded on that much. A handful of them get more characterization, like Sammy Thunder, who is an 80s rock band character who conducts a train, which is about the worst profession an 80s rock band character could have.
Oh, yeah, I remember this guy.
Yeah, so you get a lot of Sammy Thunder quests, at which point you're kind of thinking, I want to push him into the river. But you get to run into people that, you know, the game's kind of glossed over but seemed interesting. It just seems like this game was A, part experiment for their 3DS game, and B, just sort of like a chance for the game designers to go, hey, let's see if we can go re-explore some of these characters we liked. Now, it's worth noting, though, that the game's actually not developed by Level 5 at all. It's actually developed by Brownie Brown. I mean, I just find that this particular game to be It's not great, but it's a good time sink, and earning money is really easy, unlike Animal Crossing, because there's a gambling minigame that is really easy to win. You can make a ton of cash. And people just throw cash at your feet for completing the most menial tasks, like, can you go get me a drink from that restaurant 5 steps away? Here's 80,000 wealth. And you're like, okay, I'll take it. And then your happiness increases by 6,000, because that's about the right amount to increase if something like that happens. But I'm still trying to save up money so I can walk around dressed like royalty and spend $3 million on my outfit.
Can you get the old parachute pants or whatever, do a bit of MC Hammer shit?
There's a thing called pompadour pants, which is not quite parachute pants, but it looks a bit similar. Yeah. I'm excited at the prospect of wearing those.
All right, James, do you have anything else to say about London life?
No, not really. I mean, if this game didn't have London life included, I would still enjoy it, but it wouldn't be quite the same, you know, newness. I mean, it really is the infusion of newness that this particular game needs.
Mm-hmm.
If you enjoy the Animal Crossing games, think of it as like a really simple Animal Crossing. Like, if they had made Animal Crossing on the Game Boy Advance, that's what it would be, only with latent characters and a lot weirder.
Okay. Well, John, you're up next.
Yeah, I picked up Pixel Junk Side Scroller, and I'm liking it so far. It has, some pretty cool vector style graphics. If you don't know what those are, then you should go check out Tempest. What was that game? I keep trying to think, Johnny. What was that game we played at PAX East?
Oh, it had like a really generic, the one with the roller, the trackball, and the drawing circles around things. Yeah, it's an awesome game, but it has a really generic name, and I can never remember it.
Yeah, so this is kind of an ode to those old style, you know, vector graphics, Vectrex style kind of games, but, you know, kind of updated for HD. It's good. I would classify it as good, probably not great.
Don't say anything bad, John. We'll get bad tweets.
I mean, pretty much to break it down, you know, it's a side-scrolling shooter. You have three different guns. You have a machine gun, a wall gun, which shoots upwards and downwards, and your shots, like, bounce along the walls.
Yeah, they're like bombs.
And laser, which is just a straight across shot, but they're much more powerful than the machine gun. My main problem with it is the music. I find the music so generic. It just seems completely out of place with a side-scroller shooting game.
Yeah, it's almost like a remix of the Pixel Junk Shooter soundtrack.
Yeah, and it's just
definitely some similar themes, but I agree, the music doesn't really do a whole lot for me, unfortunately.
Yeah, I downloaded this. I've just played the first stage. You get, you know, all four sectors, is it, of the first stage. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's still kind of in that more relaxing kind of vibe.
Yes.
Of shooter, you know, so I mean, that is not unexpected in that way, because it is somewhat derived from shooter. You've got some of the same fluid mechanic stuff, and it's the same developers, obviously, same series. But yeah, I guess it's for something, a game that is more like Gradius, it doesn't sound like Gradius, you know, in that way, the up-tempo kind of style that you might be used to. So there's something of a disconnect there, but I don't think it's going to bother me terribly much.
But, you know, in terms of gameplay, it's pretty basic. There's 12 levels overall, and then one epic, supposedly, that opens up at the end. So I don't know what that entails. I don't know if it's just longer than the other ones, or if it's some kind of boss rush sort of thing, but there's an epic level, apparently. So, yeah, I mean, it's good. It's good. I'm going to play through. I'm about halfway through it right now. I think I'm in section 2-2. Nothing too crazy in terms of bosses or anything like that. Fairly basic.
Well, the first boss is pretty easy, but I think really cool, but very easy, very much like a Gradius boss. The second one is way more complicated and challenging and really interesting and not really quite like anything I'd seen before. And then the final boss, which I'm at right now, I haven't beaten it yet, but I'm at the final boss on stage 3-4. It is almost something like you would get in like UN Squadron.
Oh, is it a giant battleship? Is it an R-type?
Pretty much, yeah. It's a tank, but yeah, it's a big multi-sectioned giant ground vehicle. So, and it's pretty hard, actually. So I was playing that right before we started recording, and it's going to take me a while to get through that boss, probably. But I think the game actually like you described it as relaxing. I can definitely see how you'd get that impression from the first sector, from the first set of stages. I think after that point, it picks up quite a bit, and things can get pretty hairy in some of the later levels. So it's a nice ramp up, actually. For instance, when I first started playing the game, I didn't like the laser because it was really slow and hard to aim.
Yeah.
But as you get deeper in the game, it is worth learning how to use that thing. There's some skill required to actually get good with it, and there's a lot of precision. You have to be really, really accurate with it.
Yeah.
But once you kind of get the hang of it, that thing is so powerful, you really need it to get through some of the more difficult enemies in the amount of time that you have, you know, before the stage scrolls by and sort of traps you. So I thought I was impressed with that.
Yeah, I've already ran into areas where you have to use it in order to get through walls, so you have to sort of switch back and forth. And you can also power them up, too. That's one thing I didn't mention. I think there's five different...
Yeah, five levels of each one.
How long do you think it took you to go all the way through to the end?
About 90 minutes, including, you know, a couple of restarts and stuff like that. I'd say overall it's about 90 minutes.
Yep. Now, the cool thing, the coolest thing in it, actually, is... it allows you to record. Like, you can open up the options menu, pretty much click record, come back out, record however long you want, and then post it directly to YouTube, which I thought was really cool, and I would like to actually see more shooters, you know, kind of incorporate stuff like that.
Yeah, pretty much all the pixel junk games do that.
Really?
It makes more sense in some than others. I think it does make sense in this kind of game. I mean, how many of us have watched videos of people playing Ikaruga?
Yeah.
But the reason people watch videos of people playing Ikaruga is that it's absurd. Like,
yeah.
Like, I refuse to believe that there are many other games that reach that level of insanity.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this one doesn't, but...
I'd just like to hear the words Max Chain repeated over and over and over.
Well, yeah, because anyone who has a video, it's either how bad they are at the game, it's just, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Or just the fact they've memorized where every stray bullet comes from, and they're just amazing.
But I've played more of it than you guys, and I've actually really enjoyed it. I wasn't quite sure at first. I mean, I love the presentation. I love the vector graphics and everything. But I was like, this is a little too easy and a little too simple. But the way that they pull in the mechanics of Pixel Junk Shooter and subvert those for really a different genre, even though you're still flying a ship and shooting in both games, they play completely differently. This is way more of a straightforward action game. And I really enjoyed the way that they pull in some of those elements. You know, I mean, you're no longer solving puzzles, but the physics of it, the fluid dynamics of it, the, you know, sort of searching for nooks and crannies, and even some of the same enemies, actually a lot of the same enemies. And in some cases, it's fun to see those same elements now done in a totally different graphic style. Mm-hmm. That's kind of fun, too. But the bosses, I think I'm very happy with the bosses, actually. And I think on hard mode, you know, and I'm getting close to where I'm probably going to unlock that soon, and I'm definitely going to check it out. And it has the potential to be a completely different experience, I think, on hard mode.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I just think it just needs more guitars in the soundtrack, I think.
Well, I said earlier the music seems relaxing, but yeah, the first level is pretty much a stroll as well. So I really hope that you do get a very much more significant kind of ramp up when it comes to stuff like the hard mode or whatever else.
Yeah, I think we'll find that it does. So, Greg, you're up last on the new business.
Yes, I am. So, yeah, not that much gaming's been going on. I played Arkham City a little more, but there's definitely not enough to comment on it really at length. Yeah, and I keep chipping away at Xenoblade. It's coming along. I'm kind of hoping to get it done by the time Skyward Sword gets here. I've got, 3 weeks left? Is that right?
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. I played one more hour of Xenoblade. I'm up to 2.
Nice, nice, wonderful. Without spoiling, Greg...
I've been busy.
Can you give any kind of hint as to where you are so I can give you a guess?
I'm in the other place.
Okay. Yeah, you'll be fine. You'll pull it off.
I feel like I'm making good progress in that regard, but for my new business this week, I'm going to talk about the Legend of Zelda 25th anniversary concert that took place in London this week, which I managed to attend. So so far they've just done 3 dates, one in Tokyo, one in Los Angeles, and then to round out this little phase, one in London. I understand that they are planning some sort of more broad kind of tour for next year.
But this was a, sort of the last for now of the series of concerts. And so it drew, you know, people came in. I could tell from my rampant street pass light indicator and all. I mean, it was for street passes. There's definitely nothing. I have not been to E3 or anything like PAX or anything like that. This was completely a new thing for me, just street pass getting blown up with tons of people passing through and all that. So it's kind of annoying though, because I'd still managed to get pretty much everything off the old street pass, you know, quest, the swapping the pictures, tiles and all that stuff. So
right,
if the timing had been different, and you know, the firmware update that they've talked about where they're going to have the new Find Me, you know, street pass quest, and they're going to have the new pictures and all that, it would have been a lot better, because I could have just razzed through that in about a minute. Just couldn't clear people out fast enough.
You know, on that topic, real quick, I've accumulated now hundreds of these play coins. When am I ever going to do anything with them? Are they ever going to support a game where you actually use this stuff? Because it's a really cool idea.
There are a few games that use it.
There are games that do. I mean, like DOA supports it. I think like you could use play coins like to some extent just to unlock stuff that you could unlock other ways. You have like an indicator that says, would you like to spend 10 play coins on unspecified stuff? And then if you do it, it'll get you an alternate costume and a couple of trophies or something like that.
Mm-hmm. It would be great for a Smash Brothers, like, you know, trophy lottery type.
I wouldn't be
game.
Surprised if Mario Kart uses them in some sort of way like that. You know, I mean, it really, there's no. I think Shinobi, for instance, has got like this weird Street Pass thing where if you Street Pass with people that have the game, it unlocks like challenge maps. But the alternative is to just sink play coins into it. So you might see that, you know, for a few cases where it's like, well, if you're someone who lives in a region where or has a lifestyle or whatever, that it's just never going to happen in terms of street passing with someone, at least it kind of maybe incentivizes you to still take your 3DS with you to accumulate the coins and then spend them on something like that.
That's a really good compliment, actually. And what you might find is that by taking your 3DS around to build up play coins, you might actually street pass with someone unexpectedly. So that's a really good idea.
Yeah, so I think that's what you're going to see, is more you know, utilization of the whole play coin system in that way. And of course, it's a good thing that you are going to have more pictures and stuff, because that was the other way to get pieces of the picture.
Right.
You know, if you couldn't street pass for someone to get their ones, you could just put the play coins in and you'd get a random one of a picture, which you kind of like buying stickers, you know, like if you're collecting to fill in a sticker book. And of course, you'd millions of times you'd get the same one and you'd keep spending until, you know, so that's kind of what I used to use my play coins for, but I've long since kind of filled all those in now. So I'm sitting on a big pile of play coins at the minute.
You could also use them to hire the mercenaries and Find Me, but they were always so ineffectual. It was just, you literally just threw the money away.
They were useless.
That is an option, though. That seemed pretty pointless. Maybe that'll be sort of more robust in the next.
Well, hopefully the mercenaries won't suck terribly next time. So.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like they've got like branching paths and like multiple guys on screen at the same time and stuff. So I think it could be a fun little upgrade that. But yeah, it was Street Pass again, Street Pass it everywhere. And from that, you could see that people had come into the concert from all over Europe. You know, obviously it was in London. You know, I assume that most of the people were from close to the city like me, and you know, it was pretty easy. You know, it's a short journey for me. But I understand one of our staff, Dan Koopman, made it in from the Netherlands. I was oblivious to this fact until afterwards. So these are the perils of not being on Twitter. but apparently, yeah, he was there as well. I didn't know, but the street pass people from Norway and all you know, far flung sort of corners of the continent. So you know, the people that were there, obviously, it was a big deal to them. I paid a fair amount of money for my ticket, but if you're adding, you know, travel and all that kind of stuff, some people must have been pretty passionate about this to make it.
I was going to ask, so the Street Pass firmware upgrade contains like a map thing, right? Where you can see where people came from?
That's right, yeah.
That would have been actually really cool. Yeah. In that respect, because you could just see.
You're right. I hadn't even thought about that, but it's just rubbing it in all the more that the timing.
Yeah. Well, it's. I mean, at E3, it was like that. You see people from all over the place, and you're like, man, a map would be really cool. Mm. Yeah. And then they're like, well, you missed it by 10 months, but here it is now.
So everyone was clearly, you know, really into it from the get-go, and the event was introduced by Aonuma. He actually came out. I think he's done all three, I believe. He's been a trooper, and, you know, introducing the knight through an interpreter. And then it was over to the conductor, who kind of, you know, introduced the orchestra, in this case the Royal Philharmonic, who was doing the performance. But then they had like a surprise in that sort of the unofficial MC of the evening was going to be Zelda Williams, Robin Williams' daughter, you might have seen in the Not for America Zelda right. commercials. They've been used in Japan and they've been used in Europe, but not in America. I don't know. Is that like a lost in translation thing? You know, like they took the money because it wasn't going to be shown in America and embarrass them.
That's really strange. Yeah,
it is strange, isn't it? But
she's
it was
cute. I mean, those would be effective ads in America. So I don't know. I can't see any reason why not.
NOA is just methed out somewhere going, let's just do whatever the fuck we want, guys.
So she came on and sort of introduced like blocks of songs and things that they were going to do every now and again. And you know, it was sort of awkward. I think she was genuinely nervous as well as playing up to being nervous. but, you know, there was one moment where she had like a touching little heart-to-heart with the audience about the fact that she really does love the Zelda games and her favorite is Majora's Mask. So ooh, there's this love out there.
It's good to know.
I hate it.
Fuck you.
Screw you, Zelda Williams. Screw you, crappy Zelda game.
In terms of the performance itself, you know, it was satisfying. It was very much what you'd expect. You know, the classics or most memorable themes being performed by an orchestra. So, you know, and that's as much of it was, you know, not like hugely surprising or anything, but nonetheless impressive with the way it was performed and the way it was orchestrated. But there were a few highlights I wanted to point out. First of all, they did two symphonic movements, which are basically synopses of Wind Waker on the one hand and Twilight Princess on the other, through the soundtracks. So in the case of Wind Waker, you know, you went from the outset island to the pirate ship to the great sea, you know, all through basically a sort of mini journey through the game's soundtrack, culminating in the battle with Ganon and the final credit sequence set to, you know, footage of the game that was synced up with it on the sort of the projector behind the orchestra. It was just really effective the way it sort of segued from one to the next, and especially, you know, certain parts of that soundtrack. Obviously, it was at the stage, you know, where Nintendo was very much composing Zelda soundtracks with a cinematic frame of mind. They had cutscenes, they had, you know, more sort of range of synth to imitate a sort of symphonic style. But at the same time, it still wasn't there. You know what I mean? Like, there's still bits right. where the synth quality is a bit weak for the kind of grandeur that they're going for, so that when you actually have a live orchestra, it really comes across the original intent being sort of fully realized, especially something like the battle with Ganon, you know, which is very dramatic and bombastic. It just comes across a lot better. And the Twilight Princess one was good too, but though probably not as memorable for me, maybe because the Twilight Princess soundtrack is a bit more melancholy. It's not as sort of bright and fun as the Wind Waker one, I would say.
It's not quite the same departure the Wind Waker one is either.
Yeah, well, it's not as Celtic and, you know, all that kind of stuff, but it's also just more atmospheric, which doesn't necessarily lend itself to this medium that well.
No,
there was still some good stuff though. Like, you know, when they have when you speak to the sages at the what was it called, you know, it's not the spirit temple, but it's a lot like it in the desert,
right?
The sort of prison place. We speak to the spirits of the sages, and you've got the quiet choir. Well, yeah, they actually did that with a live choir and all that, so that really came across. That was really nice. But the overworld theme is probably my favourite overworld theme of any of the Zelda games in Twilight Princess. So hearing that,
it's very good.
Hearing that with the full orchestra was fantastic. I really enjoyed that. But I mean, outside of those two kind of twin symphonic movements, there was still a lot of fun stuff. I would say it was very much sort of ocarina-centric, which is understandable from the point of view, one, it came out this year to coincide with the 25th anniversary, two, it's one of the most popular and well-known Zelda games, and three, it's heavily sort of based around music as a game in many ways, and also it's the first game where they kind of really went in that kind of cinematic direction with the music, although again, the N64 synth was not always well qualified for that. And so again, like stuff like they have like a sort of montage of themes associated with Ganon, including the battle with Ganondorf and then the final battle with the Beast Ganon and all that, and that was really powerful now with the full orchestra doing it. That was awesome. But yeah, there was perhaps a bit too much dependence on Ocarina for my taste personally. You know, I would have liked to hear a bit more from some more obscure corners of the series, which is to say that there wasn't any of that kind of stuff. There was some little medleys where they snuck things in that I really enjoyed. Like my personal favourite was the theme from Latte, the Clocktown Milk Bar in Majora's Mask. That is really fun to hear that being played. It's sort of, in the context of Majora's Mask, it's like Muzak or something.
Yeah, it is.
But to hear that being played by an orchestra is really funny.
In the context of that game, though, it's kind of, it really is different than most of the music in that game, too, which is,
because it's very sort of light and bubbly and kind of funny, and that's the purpose it served here. And also, yeah, some other cases I really like, the Link to the Past, the Light World Dungeon theme, where, yeah, that always had like a strong kind of brass component to it in the Super NES, since it didn't really come across, that was just perfect with the brass section of the orchestra. It was much better. But I mean, where it was disappointing for me is that, for instance, I mean, Zelda 2 and Link's Awakening both got shut out, as far
really?
As I could tell. I don't think there was a single thing from those. And now, yeah, those are not games that I grew up playing or anything. The first time I played Zelda 2 all the way through was the retroactive we did 2.5 years ago.
But it has some great music.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and the only the first time I played through Link's Awakening all the way through was this year with the eShop. But for that reason, I thought it would perhaps get in because it is topical in that sense.
Well, and it's kind of funny because the entire premise of Link's Awakening is to make it, or to get the opportunity to play a damn song.
Yeah, all the instruments to play the Ballad of the Windfish, and that, I thought, that had to get in there somewhere.
Yeah, it's because it's a really good song.
I thought, surely, because, I mean, the first time I ever heard the Ballad of the Windfish is not actually in the game, but there was an Ocarina Orchestra CD where they finished the album with a song that was actually a medley from all the other games. And the very ending of it is the Ballad of the Windfish. And I thought, that's lovely. Where's that from? And I sort of guessed it might be from the Game Boy one. And of course it was. So I was really disappointed still, even though I've not grown up with it or anything, not to hear that. And there was a moment towards the very end where Koji Kondo was brought out to play the piano. And I thought, he's going to play Ballad of the Windfish on the piano. But he didn't. He played the scene for when you have a heart-to-heart with your grandmother in Wind Waker. Instead, which it was nice. It was completely.
Yeah, it's a really effective scene, actually. But
it's completely different from, you know, everything that was on show the rest of the night. But that was one of the moments. You know, the crowd reacting to Koji Kondo being brought on stage was pretty bad. You know, this legend being brought.
Yeah, and I would venture to say that you guys probably are. I mean, these limited. You know, they did one in Japan, or one in Tokyo, one in London, and one in L.A. And those are probably the only times he's going to go out there, because I'm sure he's not going to be touring with the...
He might show up for some of the Japan shows, but yeah.
But maybe they'll get other people to be guests.
It'd be nice. I mean, there's a pretty big sort of swath of composers that have contributed to Zelda at this point. But I mean, I think it was generally very, very effective. I mean, there was probably a handful of occasions where I felt like perhaps it was just the way it was orchestrated, or perhaps just a bad choice. You know, something like the Gerudo Valley theme. It's a very popular song from Ocarina of Time, but doing it without like the Spanish kind of vibe, you know, the Latin guitar and all that, doing it just, you know, with an sort of very straight kind of orchestral arrangement with strong brass, it just didn't work for me. Now, in some cases you might say, well, you know, wouldn't you rather hear something like in a way that you haven't heard it before? You know, and I understand that, and there's some like remixes and stuff that totally work for me in that way, but for whatever reason this didn't. And mostly what worked was hearing things, as Johnny said, like when he's talking about Mario and jazz, like as it was probably playing in the composer's head.
Greg, we've heard reports that at least at the Los Angeles show, a lot of people are kind of chatting away in the audience and maybe not being as respectful as you should when you go see an orchestra. I'm willing to bet that the London audience was somewhat more well-behaved, but what was your experience?
Well, chatting. There wasn't a lot of chatting. There was not a lot of ambient murmuring or anything like that. I mean, there was cheering and stuff.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
So sometimes it's just the things that were happening on the screen. Like, oh, they're playing the dungeon theme for the original Zelda, and there's footage on the screen of Link kind of walking along and like bumping into the wall instead of the door, and everyone's laughing. And I probably could have done without that, to be honest, but it wasn't really obnoxious or anything. I didn't think it was too bad in that regard. So I don't know, maybe it was worse in LA, but I mean, I did read TYP's account of the event over in LA, you know, and I agreed with a lot of what he had to say about the event, really. It was just generally really good, but maybe there was a, you know, a bit too much ocarina, and there was a couple of themes that, as lovely as they are, might have been ill-suited for the sort of orchestral medium. But overall, it was pretty magical, actually. I'm very much in the mood for Skyward Sword right about now.
Aren't we all?
Well, it's worth noting that the first batch of copies of Skyward Sword will come with a recording from one of these concerts, presumably the Tokyo one.
Yeah, because that should have maintained the most strict decorum, I would imagine.
Well,
yeah,
and they will have had the most time to process it, too.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to hearing that, and, you know, I'm very jealous that you got to go to this, but you know, one of the problems of living in Colorado is you're not really near any other major population centers. So if they don't come to Denver, I probably don't get to do it, but hopefully they will.
Probably, you know, reflected on it, the most impressive thing of the night was when they did Hyrule Field from Ocarina of Time. The way they almost had that kind of schizophrenic quality to it, because, you know, in the game it's dynamic, and so, you know, when you happen upon an enemy, like, they did actually sort of mimic that quite well, the sort of turn on a dime, like going to the really dramatic, you know, intense, almost dissonant sections where you'd be fighting an enemy. And again, that came across a lot more, so the sort of power of that shift when it was actually orchestral, which of course is a difficult chestnut for Nintendo to crack in terms of, like, with Skyward Sword, because obviously this is something they dealt with, I think, very elegantly in Galaxy, where they want to have this orchestral music, but at the same time they want to retain the dynamic elements that they're, you know, kind of known for in their soundtrack. So I assume they've pulled the same trick with Skyward Sword just as well.
Yeah, so Iwata actually spoke about this in the most recent asks of his. So what they've done historically is they've recorded or written a bunch of different pieces, and then they have ways to blend them together, which means they have to come up with transitions for all these different locations. But that's a lot easier in a computer than it is on performances.
Yeah.
So they've recorded a bunch of things, and then they're using the digital music to sort of bridge these transitions, so you don't have to record,
mix them together and stuff. Yeah, I assume they have to, like, change tempo and all that kind of stuff. I mean,
yeah, and so you can do a bit with fades, but you're gonna have to build a bridge at some point between the fading in and the fading out, and they're basically doing that digitally. I'm kind of surprised, though, that they didn't include, like, maybe wrap the concert up with one Skyward Sword.
Oh, they did. They did with the very final moments of the concert was, you know, it's coming out in a few weeks. Make sure you buy it and tell your friends, and it's the CD's coming with it, you know, the full sales pitch.
You have to have the wizard moment at the end. A new game, and, you know, show the video and everything. I mean,
right.
What better way to hype up your devoted fans?
It was funny, actually. Aiden was speaking through a translator, was saying, basically, there is a new Zelda game coming out, you know, trying to get the crowd pumped up. There's a new Zelda game coming out in a few weeks. Do you know what it's called? And thrust the microphone out to the crowd, not realizing that he just said it in Japanese and we had no idea what he meant.
Oh, God.
And so then
classic.
Passed the microphone back to the interpreter, who then said the same thing, and then everyone did the pantomime Skyward Sword.
In a sense, it's a bit silly to try to promote Skyward Sword to an audience of people who paid probably a lot of money to see a Zelda concert.
Yeah, it is.
Like they just wandered in off the street and had no idea that they were in a concert.
Yeah, there's something to be said for pumping up your loyal fan base, though. I'm kind of glad they're doing that.
That was a nice way to end the night, the Skyward Sword theme. And like I said, the appetite has been firmly whetted for the soundtrack in that now. I appreciate that it probably was tricky for them, with a game with so much music, and they want the dynamic stuff, so it probably was, especially for Nintendo, who's not done it very many times, you're quite an undertaking to pull that off. And supposedly it was quite a recent decision. But I don't know what you want to...
E3.
Supposedly, Miyamoto gave them the go-ahead after they did the orchestra thing on stage of E3. Whether you believe that or not is up to you. But I'm glad they went to the extra effort anyway, because I think it's going to be fantastic.
Okay, well, that's going to wrap up new business, and now we're taking a break. And when we come back, we've got your listener mail, so don't leave.
Don't leave? Don't leave.
Don't leave.
Where are they going to go?
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with reviews, rather a lot of reviews at this time of year, as you might expect. First up is James Dawson's review of Aliens Infestation for DS. He notes that with Metroid as its inspiration, the game certainly has a lot to live up to, a sentiment that I echo, but you can see how much it lived up to it in James' mind in his review. And next up, there's the completion of our Spider-Man Edge of Time disappointment round, with Zach Miller's review of the DS version, which apparently does whatever two Spider-Men can't.
Oh, okay, we have a review of Professor Layton and the Last Spectre by Neil Ronahan, and he says that it is a game of Layton with a side of Animal Crossing. Sounds like a good meal. Elsewhere on the review front, for Wii, we have Kirby's Return to Dreamland by Pedro Hernandez. If Epic Yarn was like pants, Return to Dreamland is like a warm sweater of love and nostalgia.
Does that sound like a good meal too, John?
Sounds yummy. Love and nostalgia. Warms the belly.
Aaron Kaluska has impressions of Mario Kart 7, which he discusses the new features that make for a great racing experience. And we also have impressions for Super Mario 3D Land from Dan Koopman. It's the second part of his impressions from playing all the way through the game. Now that we've gotten out of the embargo, you need to look out for spoilers.
Next up, there's a feature on Nintendo's expansion ports by Aaron Kaluska and Danny Bivens, and James notes that a lot of other staff members contributed to it as well. It's an exhaustive look at how past Nintendo consoles were built to support add-ons, with pictures included. Some of these might surprise you. And finally, we've got a feature called 60 Days and Counting of No Wii Virtual Console. Sadly, it looks like the Virtual Console on Wii in North America is just about dead. To celebrate slash mourn, we're going to list a good Virtual Console game for every day that has passed since the last one came out way back in August. So if you're looking to kind of go back and maybe catch up on a few that you missed, or if you just want to reminisce on the greatness of Virtual Console on Wii, and it is very great, there's a really good list there, and I don't know, maybe one day they'll revive it, but for now it's looking pretty dead.
Well, this Double Dragon is coming for sure at some point. They did the Game Boy one, there's going to be an NES follow-up to that. And Mega Man X2 was rated by the ESRB for what that's worth.
That's true. That's a fantastic game.
Maybe there's a little life in the old dog yet, but it's pretty much the end.
All right. Be sure to go and check out all of this great original content and probably even more reviews by the time you hear this. It is that time of year, as Greg said, so be sure to check back every day over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, and it's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We really appreciate everybody who sends in a letter. It's an old-fashioned way to do things, and it works out really well. So
it's old-fashioned. It's email.
It's old-fashioned to write out an email to a podcast. I think it is.
These days, tweeting, shitting.
Well, the thing is, I will say, though, I only read the first 140 characters of any email we receive, for the record. I can't process anything further than that.
Okay, so the first one's from Dustin. So where's the love for Kirby, RFN? On the Wii holiday season recap, there was no mention of the recently released Return to Form Kirby Wii game, Return to Dreamland. And then in the Nintendo 64 recap episode, despite being on one of the host's lists, Kirby 64 was not mentioned. Kirby 64 is one of my favorite Nintendo 64 games, and I think it deserves more credit. Not only for being a very novel and well-designed game, but also for its simple and vibrant graphics, which, in my opinion, makes it one of the few 64 games that still holds up pretty well today. And the new Wii game is one of the first new real Kirby games. There have been countless ports and spin-offs, but none with the classic gameplay since Kirby 64. It also had an interesting development cycle, being first announced for GameCube, cancelled, then brought back to life on the Wii even after Kirby's Epic Yarn.
Yeah, so TYP had Kirby 64 on his list.
Right. I would have as well.
And there was a, he did mention it again in something that got cut out very briefly in amongst a bunch of other stuff. But the main thing he was praising in that, which I think is something that a lot of people praise Kirby 64 for, is the power combining mechanics in that game.
I mean, it's, to be fair, it was a relatively not hugely controversial game. And a lot of the games we talked about were games that really just don't get talked about that much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, we spent a good 2.5 minutes on Mission Impossible for the N64.
Yeah, that's pretty obscure.
Yeah, which I'm glad you did. That's a really cool game, actually. I liked hearing you guys talk about that because it's very interesting. But I think the notable thing about Kirby 64 is that it was a side-scrolling platformer on a platform that had really not that many of them, especially not prominent ones. I mean, there's a few sort of obscure things like Mystical Ninja, the second one, Goemon's Great Adventure, or, you know, Mischief Makers. But these are not well-known, widely available games. Kirby 64 was, and it was really strange for Nintendo to start a generation with Super Mario 64, which was really the, you know, as you talked about, the prototypical 3D platformer, and then go back to their roots with a 2D side-scrolling Kirby game.
Very, very late.
Very late in the system, and it was very pleasurable. You know, it was really a nice return to form for them.
Well, obviously, they had done so already with Yoshi's Story, which we did a retroactive on.
Which was much earlier.
Let's say much more successfully in the case of Kirby 64.
Yeah, but that's the point. I think Yoshi's Story didn't make it on any of our lists. I wouldn't have been inclined to talk about it having featured it in a retroactive before anyway. But my understanding was that, yes, Kirby was, you know, similar in the sense that it's still, you know, perhaps aimed at, you know, the similar sort of demographic. But instead of the pre-rendered graphics of Yoshi's Story, which certainly are one of its strengths, it used polygonal graphics for its very bright, vibrant aesthetic that Dustin mentions. Yeah. But yeah, it's always kind of intrigued me. I kind of thought to see, you know, if I had gone to it back then, whether I would have enjoyed it. So it's kind of teased as a virtual console purchase, but I never would have bought it at the time because the reputation of Kirby, which I'm sure is well earned in most cases, is that it's very easy and short and all that. And so as game,
I had the luxury of renting it. And I probably rented it a couple times.
Now,
but
there are a lot of crystal shards to collect, but you won't, because you just you won't feel motivated to get them all. Now, briefly on the other game, the Return to Dreamland, three of us here have played this game.
I've played it.
And I don't, and John being the only admission, and I don't think that any of us really felt all that strongly about it having played it.
No, exactly. I mean, that's when we did the holiday preview. The point was we were picking games that we were personally interested in. Right. You know, some of those already, you know, have not panned out all that well in the case.
or actually, we're panning out in the process of us mentioning them.
It's certain Spider-Man related products, but it was just something of a personal interest rather than, you know, like some sort of order of merit of the pedigree of the game or whatever. So obviously, it has a pretty good pedigree behind it. But what's interesting in terms of the development history that Dustin mentioned is that, you know, sort of they came out recently, you know, as they do with the Iwata Ass or whatever, when they were talking about what happened to the GameCube Kirby, is that it was cancelled, basically. You know, that I guess that this isn't Return to Dreamland, at least they're not saying is literally that game reheated, but it was all about a four player simultaneous kind of multiplayer. But then they canned it or put it on hold or whatever, and then started developing like a 3D platformer with Kirby. They're kind of vague on it, but it sounds, you know, it sounds like it could be quite different. And then at some point they were looking at more of a 2D kind of pop up books style aesthetic Kirby
Yoshi
game.
Yoshi Story-ish.
The Yoshi Story, which never happened either. So, you know, they were when we kept seeing the Kirby on the release schedule for Wii.
It was different Kirby's.
It was like, we don't know what which Kirby game is going to be, but there is going to be one.
And it's definitely going to be called Hoshino Kirby.
Japan.
It's actually going to be called Duke Kirby Forever.
What's funny about the development cycle this went through, though, is that it kind of, like Eric said, it started as the four-player 2D-ish Kirby and ended there. And if it had beaten New Super Mario Brothers to the punch, I think it would be much more noteworthy. But this really is the third or fourth two-player or more side-scroller Nintendo has put out in the last couple of years, depending on which numbers you want to count.
Yeah, for the very reason that Kirby 64 was notable back then, this one is not, because it really doesn't seem to be doing anything that hasn't been done recently. And I would say the other thing is, I mean, I understand that people like playing a Kirby game on a console, and it has been obviously two generations since that happened, but on the handheld, where Kirby got his start and is totally the legitimate home of the Kirby franchise, there have been bunches of Kirby games since Kirby 64. Mm-hmm. We have no shortage of them whatsoever, and I would say actually the GBA when Kirby's Amazing Mirror is probably the best Kirby game ever. And if you haven't played that, it is very much a traditional Kirby game, and that has all the mechanics that you want, just put into a little bit more fully fleshed out, interesting, non-linear world. But it is totally a Kirby game, and if you haven't played it, you're doing yourself a disservice. And there's three more after that. So I don't buy that this is like the first real Kirby game since, 1997 or whenever Kirby 64 came out. That's
bullshit. On DS you had Canvas Curse, you already mentioned, but that's a spin-off. But there was Squeak Squad, which I guess was more traditional. But
You like cake, then yeah, Squeak Squad is for you.
People don't think of that very highly, so maybe that's the issue there. But Amazing Mirror is worth mentioning in this context from the point of view that had four-player multiplayer capacity.
Yes.
But of course, it was sort of shackled by the GBA cable multi-cart thing. I guess that would have been a real problem. It sounds like it'd be a hoot.
Well, as an ambassador game with wireless functionality, eventually.
Well, this is it. It seems like it may well be in the ambassador program, but of course, the initial release of that, assuming that there is going to be a final one, Nintendo playing coy about that, the initial release will not have any kind of multiplayer emulation. But maybe if down the line they put it on general sale or whatever, maybe we could get something like that, which would be really cool. But I understand it's still well worth looking into as a single player game. So.
Yes, absolutely it is. Yes.
Yep.
Check that out if you haven't. If you're in the ambassador program, you'll probably get it here in the next couple of months. So make sure you play it. It's fantastic. But yeah, I mean, Return to Dreamland, the Wii game, I don't love Kirby enough to play a third Kirby game within the span of 11 months.
Yeah.
So I felt that Mass Attack was far, far more interesting of the Kirby games coming out this fall, and I don't feel compelled to pick up both of them.
I'll be honest, even though I know the game is better than the demo we played at E3, I just didn't have even one iota of fun playing that demo. So it really has essentially taken away any enthusiasm I would have had for the game.
Okie doke. Well, thanks for the letter, Dustin. I hope this episode has satisfied your zeal for Kirby Talk on the podcast.
KirbyWorldReport.com.
All right, James has the next letter.
Adolf Vega in Arlington, Texas writes, "The 3DS will eventually get a redesign, but I think redesigning it will be very difficult. Nintendo would want to make the slide pad extension obsolete. Therefore, they would include a second circle pad and two more shoulder buttons. However, where exactly would they place two more shoulder buttons on the 3DS without making it really thick and or awkward? You would think the second circle pad would be below the face buttons, but that might be cramming a lot of tech and be difficult to accomplish. Outside of those issues, I think the 3DS will need either a wider touchscreen to keep flush with the 3DS screen when closing, or make the 3DS screen smaller. Excuse me, the 3D screen smaller. Now, the battery and the camera should be easy fixes to upgrade. I know Johnny is an engineer, so I want to know your opinions on how difficult redesigning the 3DS will be."
I'm not that kind of engineer.
I'm a fucking computer scientist with a computer engineering minor. Come on.
He operates trains. I thought everybody knew that. Choo-woo! Everybody get aboard the Johnny Metz Express.
It's that woo-woo!
Oh, the woo-woo!
Yeah, this is far outside my specialty as an engineer, trust me. I mean, I'm certainly happy to speculate on it, but I have no more or no less expertise on the subject of handheld gaming redesigns than these other guys, and James probably has the most, actually.
Well, I think the one thing I would raise is whether... You know, Adolf says Nintendo would want to make the slide pad expansion obsolete and would therefore include second circle pad, two more shoulder buttons. I would say not so fast, not necessarily. I don't think that's a deal. I mean, they may well do. It may depend on, you know, the sort of uptake from the third parties or, you know, their own ambitions with games of controls of that sort and this, that, and the other. Maybe it depend on what Vita does, having them both built in even. But I don't think it's a given. I really don't. I mean, I think there's a key constraint that has emerged now. As we've said before, the redesign will be a way for Nintendo to get a more favorable configuration of hardware cost and then price. Yeah, how much it costs them to make, but how much they could sell it for than the current 3DS after the huge price cut that they've enacted. Yes. So they're going to want to get their margin back up, in which case it's a bit restrictive because they can't really, if they are going to increase the price, let's say, modestly or keep it about where it is currently.
No, they're going to go way higher. They're going to do it like the XL. It's going to be the super premium version.
Yeah. Well, it's another way to go. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because they're already going to be trying to sell it to people who already bought a 3DS, right? Mm-hmm. And as you said, they need to make up the margin that they lost with this massive price cut on the original 3DS. So I think they're going to price it at $250, basically the original price. But in order to do that, they're going to have to put in features and components that make it feel like it's worth it. You know, that especially for a fan, it's going to feel like this is what the original should have been at this price. And these components, you know, obviously aren't going to cost Nintendo a whole lot to put in there, but they need to be things that make the user feel like they're really getting their money's worth. I think a second circle pad is a way to do that. Even if it's not really an important feature, I think it's relatively inexpensive to include, as you can sort of see from the price of the add-on.
Yep.
And having it all in one module that's more ergonomic than this big Frankenstein thing is a premium feature that people will probably be willing to pay for.
So I think actually you can look at the Circle Pad Pro is how they refer to it now. It is. I think you can look at the Pro and sort of get an idea of what they would like to do, because it doesn't cost money, or not especially a large amount of money, to make the 3DS more ergonomic than it currently is. Right now, it is not a very ergonomic system.
Right.
But the Pro actually does address this somewhat by putting in a little bit of extra space as a grip on the bottom. I could see them very easily doing that. Now, it won't quite be flat, but, you know, not all portable devices are entirely flat on the back.
It's true, but I don't think they're going to make it this much less portable.
No, not that much, but they could certainly make it a bit more comfortable.
Yeah, some kind of compromise. I could see that.
But I think this discussion shows that I think there's a bit of a fork in the road with a redesign in terms of, if you think of what they did with the DS Lite, they tried to clean up the design and make it prettier, smaller, lighter, and make it...
Yeah, they were starting from a pretty bad place.
They were starting from a pretty bad place, but they were also trying to make it more presentable, I would say, to a wider market, and that was a huge role. I think that the sleekness, the simplicity, the dignity of the DS Lite compared to its predecessor made it a lot more sort of attractive, you know, quite literally, to people you know, all around the world, not just in Japan, where it could certainly, you know, the DS had been doing sort of well, I think, sooner in Japan, even in the fat model, but it sent them soaring there. And certainly in the Western markets, had a big role to play. Now, if you come in and say, right, we're putting extra shoulder buttons, and we're putting another circle pad on there, you aren't going to achieve that with this redesign at all. What you're doing is what Johnny talked about, which is, right, let's get more money again out of the people that might have paid the initial price. Or maybe people that actually held off. But either way, you're appealing to people whose primary concern is the functionality of the device or how it feels in the hands, your practical concerns rather than aesthetic concerns.
How about a more responsive touchscreen? 3DS touchscreen is fucking terrible. It's terrible. You have to push so hard with the stylus. I think it's worse than the original DS.
I haven't observed that, but
I mean, it's basically a brand new system. It's not like mine's been through a lot of wear and tear to wear away the cushioning layer or whatever that they have underneath that thing. But I found that I a lot of times will tap on the touchscreen and it will not register. And that's before I got an iPhone, which is definitely a completely different touch experience, but multi-touch bullshit aside, I think they should consider, and you know, again, as I said before, you could do that without actually having to reprogram the software. Just make it more responsive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a premium feature. It would be more expensive, but capacitive touchscreens are, you know, not hard to manufacture these days. I think they could make a huge margin on it.
Now, one thing worth noting, though, he had mentioned widening the screen, but there's a... That's probably not in the cards for a bunch of reasons. Namely, games wouldn't support it, but also you'd have to completely rework the ergonomics of the buttons.
Well, oh, you mean on the touchscreen?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. You're also not really going to change the size or the ratio of the 3D screen because it will mess with the 3D effect.
But you know, it would mess. But if you mess with the bottom screen, you'd actually have to mess with the button layout. And you'd end up with some like Frankenstein wide system that looks like a laptop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We call it the DSi XL.
I mean, the initial design put some restrictions on them in that regard. But also, I mean, like I said, the alternative, though, to going that way is to maybe to try and make it at an affordable price kind of more attractive to a wider demographic. And if they're going to go that way, I don't know that you would put second circle pad on it necessarily. I guess the question is whether they think that this, but that, you know, that is viable anymore.
Right.
You know, how much do they think is in play for people to say, you know, this is a handheld gaming device that kind of, you know, people have said that the 3DS, you know, is a bit that triple decker thing, and that, you know, it's a bit angular at the, you know, it could used to be sort of
these are minor
compared to the original DS, but still, think of the GBA and then the SP, you know, what a sort of form factor thing that was. It'd be weird to actually sort of beef up in the second iteration, but then they did the XL. That was obviously very like the latter most.
Well, the DSi was actually a little bit bigger too than the original.
The screens were bigger, yeah, but wasn't it lighter overall?
It's a little bit longer, but thinner, I think.
Yeah,
DSi is a strange sort of give and take on dimensions and everything. But the other thing, I mean, Greg, you mentioned making the current model more attractive. I think they've already done that. You know, I mean, that with the price cut and then actually releasing games people want, people aren't buying the 3DS because it's ugly or because they don't care for the design of it or whatever. I mean, it's more practical than that. And Nintendo knows that, and they're doing what they can to address those things. So I don't think they want to release another model that's sort of going after the same demographic they tried the first time.
I also think that they're trying to hedge their bets, though.
The difference is, once you get to the point where they have a software library, where they've got some of the games, you know, that Chris Kohler talked about, you know, that for instance, they don't really have yet, but they had Nintendogs, but, you know, some of the other kinds of experiences, you know, Animal Crossing is yet to come. The Tomodachi collection is a big thing in Japan.
Just want to get people's attention, just put out new colors.
They're doing that in Japan to some extent. They're doing it here. They do bundles with colors, with like Mario 3D Land and stuff. I mean, you know, the games, the colors. I mean, they're putting it together, and that's something they did even with the DS Fat before they got onto the light.
You had the teal one and the pink one for Nintendogs.
But I think that's where having the system be a bit sleeker, a bit lighter, a bit more attractive would pay off more, is once you actually get to the point where you have a gaming library that could appeal to the kind of demographic that, you know, bought a DS Lite and that was actually influenced by that in some way. I mean, as it stands, that it doesn't really, you know, make much that much sense. But if you move on to the point where you've got all the expanded audience stuff, which, you know, some of that stuff is on the way, clearly, at least for the Japanese market, whether their sort of equivalents are going to be as big in the Western market is yet to be determined. But yeah, I think there's more than one direction they can go with this redesign. But a lot of it is going to be about making the numbers work with how much it costs to make and how much they think they could sell it for.
So let's get back to Adolf's question then. It was mostly about ergonomics and arranging, you know, sort of architecting this thing. I do think the second circle pad, if there was one, let's assume for now that there would be, I think it would go under the buttons as he proposed. That's the, you know, I mean, if you look at the GameCube controller, for instance, that's the way they went with that. And it's also the Xbox style. So
yeah.
I think it's quite likely they would stick with that. But then the other thing, as for the secondary shoulder buttons, I think they could do a little bit of a cutaway on the bottom of the unit. and let you use a middle finger to do that, you know? Not as severe, just a mild sort of dip into the plastic and put a little trigger inside there that would be kind of easy to do, but it would still sit flat, you know?
It does present an interesting problem, doesn't it? Because if you say, for instance, if you was just designing a 3DS from scratch, I'd say we could have two circle pads on it. You wouldn't necessarily say immediately, well, we've got to have two sets of shoulder buttons as well, would you? And you might say, well, you know, we want to keep it as compact as we can so people will take it with them and all that kind of stuff, you know, the street pass. I mean, it's a big part of the thing. So making it not a big paperweight to carry around is an issue. And you would think, well, we don't need another two. Let's leave them off. But now, because you've got the Circle Pad Pro and it includes those extra buttons, and therefore games that are designed with the second circle pad in mind will also be designed with the second lot of shoulder buttons in mind, it would be a problem to say, well, let's have the second circle pad, but not the second lot of shoulder buttons.
So there's actually a pretty simple way of doing it without expanding the screen. It's not super comfortable, but on the current model, which is to just have a second set of buttons just beyond the R and L.
Yeah, the original classic controller style.
Right.
Which is not a good style, but it would be one way of circumventing that.
Or you could reverse engineer the Xbox 360 controller and go back to the Duke style of having the white and black buttons that were on the original Xbox controller. You could sort of add them as face buttons as a workaround if you just don't think there's any good packaging to do four shoulder buttons on a thin handheld.
I don't think that would be in play. But here's one thing that is worth noting is that they are going to release the Circle Pad Pro in outside of Japan. Now, that means any redesign the 3DS gets either needs to absorb the changes the Circle Pad Pro presents or be compatible with the unit.
Or have its own version, I suppose.
But see, I'm not sure Nintendo wants to get into having to make a new version every time they want to release a 3DS.
They make a new version of the power adapter. They used to make new versions of the link cables every time they put out a new GBA. I mean,
yeah, believe it or not, they actually even bothered to do another version of the Rumble Pack for the DS Lite. That happened.
Yeah,
I know, but
they're totally weird about stuff like that, man.
I don't know. Because at that point, you'd have to have them both on the market, and it just seems like it would be too confusing.
I know what you mean, but as I say, this is not Nintendo's first rodeo with changing hardware
designs. It's not.
Throws it. Multiple SKUs.
I mean, they haven't done the link cables in a while, obviously.
But it is awkward. I mean, there's no getting around that. You know, just the whole fact that this Circle Pad Pro thing exists in the first place is awkward, and then the connotation for whether you'd have a different version of the hardware that's that fundamentally different that way is awkward. You know, I mean, Nintendo typically has been very strict about sticking to, they never said, actually, with the advances we've made in the form factor and all that, let's put, another couple of face buttons on a GBA or this, they never did that, the DS as well. They've been very, very much against that idea of, sort of expanding the input set just because they can now, maybe, whereas they couldn't before because of form factor restrictions. So I think they'll still be stubborn about it, but clearly because they've already crossed the line with this Circle Pad Pro thing, it puts a lot of things in play that you wouldn't normally think would be.
So as far as the camera stuff, I think that's interesting. I do think the battery would be most definitely enhanced.
Yes.
Because for a premium product, it addresses one of the major complaints. It will add some cost to the system, but also you would expect it to. So if you're willing to pay more for it anyway, that's definitely an easy way to go, and it's something that's pretty easy to market for them. But upgrading the cameras, at this point, I really don't think they're going to bother with it.
No.
Because it would make it difficult to retain compatibility with all the previous software that actually uses the camera, although there's not a whole lot of it.
Well, with the operating system, you'd have to release.
What about the AR stuff and all that kind of thing? I mean, it recognizes things. I mean, in some ways, you might say, well, couldn't it do AR stuff better if it had a better camera?
Yeah, Vita will do AR better because it has much higher quality camera.
But on the other hand, you've got a problem there with, you're splitting it.
Yeah.
People who've got the original model are stuck with inferior AR games. I mean, unfortunately, is now a standard that looks likely to continue. And I mean, that's going to be a part of the update, isn't it? The 3D video taking that they announced in Japan recently. So again, they're establishing that with the current kind of model standard in mind. I just doubt they're going to bother to move move the goalposts.
But what you also do is if you put out a higher def camera for the AR, you're going to have to do at least a certain amount of reprogramming to deal with more noise. Because if you have really shitty cameras on there, there's not a lot of noise because there's not a lot of detail.
But the other thing is, and I recently learned this firsthand, most people who actually, I mean, you know, I have a 3DS, it has a camera on it, I'd never use it because I know it sucks, so I'm not going to bother with it.
Because you never got the Nyko lens kit. God.
The people who actually use the camera think it's good enough.
Yeah.
Because I had a relative post something on the internet about asking what's the difference between all these different Nintendo DS models and which one should I get for my little girl. And I saw this and I thought, well, you know, I'm the expert. I'm going to help out here. I'm going to explain, you know, what are the differences and make a recommendation. And I explained it and I recommended the DS Lite because it's the cheapest model on the market and it does everything that the DSi can do that's worth doing.
It's also indestructible, pretty much.
The XL is indestructible.
Yeah, but it's too big for a child to carry around. You need three children to carry that thing around.
Yeah, the XL is almost too big for a child, and also it's fairly expensive still. It's still $180 or something. So, you know, I figured, you know, it's the DS Lite is, I think, still a very attractive product for someone getting a first DS. It's still probably the best choice. Especially for a child. And it's like $100 or so. I mean, you can get one really cheap now, and it plays all the games, you know. I mean, the stuff that's exclusive DSi is, I think, not worth even considering. And I mentioned that, you know, the DSi does have a camera, but it's not very good, and you're not really missing much if you don't have it. Well, three or four other people jumped in on this thread to defend the DSi camera and said, I think the pictures come out just fine. So people who actually use the DSi camera think it's okay, think it's good enough, basically. I mean, they might admit that it could be better, but they don't care. You know, they're not taking family photos with it.
Yeah.
I think the still shots look shitty, but I mean, I don't really care. The only reason I would like to see it upgrade, I'm never going to use this as my primary camera, you know, but the only reason I'd like to see it upgraded is because of the other things you can do with it, like put your face into a game or do augmented reality or take 3D photos or 3D video. That's something that no other device I own can do, but the 3DS can barely do it either because the camera is so shitty. So I would like to see it upgraded for those features when, you know, those things I might actually use, whereas now I really don't very much. But I just don't think Nintendo sees the economic viability unless the 640 by 480 cameras that they use become difficult to procure from their vendors. Because they're the only device in the world still using that shitty of a camera.
If their sales go well, they won't be difficult to procure.
Yeah, I think they're going to at least wait until the next generation when they no longer support DSiWare compatibility.
Right, I mean, if you can...
Which could be with this redesign, but they'll probably retain it for this. It'll probably be the one after that, like the equivalent of the DSi that no longer plays GBA games. It'll be like that second redesign where they say, you know, we're just going to make a clean break, and that will allow them to maybe upgrade the cameras.
See, I don't see them ever removing DSiWare support from the 3DS. It's a economically unsound proposal because it cuts off the ability for them to sell you stupid shit and take 20% of the money.
That's a really good point. John has the next letter.
All right, Sam in Idaho writes, if I'm talking to friends at my school and video games come up, I don't tend to mention that I recently purchased a 3DS, being that I would likely be ridiculed for buying a gaming system for kids. It does not play Modern Warfare, so it must be for kids. I like first-person shooters as much as the next guy, but it seems to me like Portal and Half-Life are some of the only games that I can mention with little ridicule due to their shooter-like gameplay. In general, it looks to me that the general public is slow to accept that there are good games that aren't shooters. We may be getting closer to games like RPGs, true RPGs like Radiant Historia, not Pokemon, becoming more popular with leveling up and character customizing being incorporated into Call of Duty. But will a game like Radiant Historia ever be quote-unquote popular and sell copies like Halo? Will consoles like the Wii or 3DS, which generally are stronger in genres like the RPG, as compared to first-person shooters, ever be viewed as something that is more than just quote-unquote kid games by the average guy on the street? Is the Wii U going to be a console that bros will buy like they do with Xboxes and PS3s? Something I've often wondered myself, will James ever be mainstream? Anyway, I love the show. Keep it up.
Public's not ready for this.
So there's an interesting philosophical question here, but before we get to that, a couple of items I want to address. First off, Pokemon is a real RPG. If Pokemon's not a real RPG, then neither is Dragon Quest. And Dragon Quest invented the Japanese role-playing game genre.
Not only is Pokemon a real RPG, it's a great RPG.
Sure.
Which is why John still hasn't fucking finished Black and White.
I did play some, actually, this weekend.
And the other thing, and maybe Sam didn't mean to imply this, but the way it reads on the page, it sounds like he's saying Wii is a stronger console for RPGs than some other system. And I just can't, maybe than N64, but I don't know what else you can fill in the blank that would make Wii a strong console for RPGs relative to anything else.
Relative to this generation? Well, they're all bad. So it's kind of like...
They're all bad, but I would say still Xbox and PlayStation are still better for RPGs than Wii, especially when you consider Western RPGs, especially.
Well, I think for me, looking at this question, it's asking a lot of things about what will happen in the future, but the way to answer it is to look into the past.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I don't know how old Sam is and at what point he is in his school education, but you know, when I was a kid, it was a similar thing. The adult games... was like Mortal Kombat, and you know, if you weren't playing Mortal Kombat, something gory or whatever, you know, it was for kids, or Nintendo stuff was for kids, or it was a baby game, or whatever, so you want to say. And of course, the irony is, in many cases, the cool stuff, the grown up stuff, is the most puerile. You know, Mortal Kombat and its fatalities, or you know, the way Gears is there.
Bulletstorm.
It's ostensibly adult, or, you know, and obviously with the modern rating systems, it's rated for adults, but...
That doesn't mean it's mature.
It's pretty infantile kind of stuff. So, I mean, that's just going to go on forever. I mean, it may not be the same dichotomies as genres in the future, you know, like FPS, it may not be the preeminent sort of genre in perpetuity, but it was the same shit when I was a kid. It was pretty, you know, it's always going to be that way, that there's just, you know, certain things that are regarded as being for adults, and it's like the forbidden fruit that kids are playing.
Well, I mean, it's like, know that these kids that are making fun of them, they aren't saying, hey, you aren't cool because you haven't played Heavy Rain, right?
Well, to be fair, if they did say that,
aren't cool if you did play Heavy Rain, and I played it, so.
Yeah, I played it too.
Yeah.
But I've never made any claim to being cool at any point in my life.
I would say that, ultimately, if you enjoy games that aren't shooters and you have friends that only want to talk about shooters, you're not going to get them to talk about Touch Detective.
Yeah, I just think that there's really not much overlap. I'm not too sure. This is kind of... See, this, to me, this gets into kind of, you know, like, jocks versus nerds territory. It's kind of like what...
Pro gamers?
Yeah, it's kind of like what Greg
the
said.
Dude bros.
Like, it's been going on forever. It just happens to be the context that it's in, but it happens in everything else, too.
Yeah, it's just going to manifest itself in different forms, somewhat different forms,
right,
you know, over time. But once you get out of school or whatever, you might find that people just look at video games a lot more as just one thing, or...
Right.
Those sort of fault lines fall away, and then different fault lines kind of emerge.
They're all regarded as puerile at that point, and then you're good to go.
Well, you could be with some people, maybe, although I think decades hence from now, yeah, that's going to be quite different because of the expansion of the industry. There's just going to be a bigger percentage of people that grew up with games, and not everyone's going to keep playing them as they get older, but still that'll inform their perceptions quite differently from someone who literally was not exposed to them at all. So, I mean, it won't always be exactly the same. This because, you know, the industry's changing, it's growing, it's broadening as well in terms of the different kinds of games that exist. But something like this is just going to keep going forever. But the good news is, from a certain point of view, you won't be that young forever. You know, that silliness is going to pass on to another generation, and you get to be grown up and not worry about such petty distinctions.
But also, don't you... I personally believe that most people have more in common with each other than they realize. And I think... I mean, look, I'm not getting all artsy-fartsy here, but when John mentioned...
Let's get the drum circle, boys.
When John mentioned the whole jocks versus nerds thing, I thought most jocks and nerds, if they spend enough time together and if they could get rid of their preconceptions, would probably find that they actually are interested in some of the same things.
Well, that's just it, right? It's putting people in a box. That's effectively what it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you can always, there are ways to fight that. And I really strongly believe in that. And I think, you know, for Sam, if you've got your 3DS and you're, you know, you would like to not be ridiculed for it, why don't you show them the 3D effect? It's easy to do, and I bet they'll be impressed by it. At the same time, if they actually play several games that you don't play, then maybe ask them to try to find one that they could introduce you to. Now, if they only play Modern Warfare and you don't like that, that's hard to do.
I mean, I don't, and this sort of informs my opinion on this question, but I don't need to talk about games with people. Hi, guys. And in general,
he doesn't need to do it. He does it out of the goodness of his heart.
There you go. For you, the listener. In general, I really only talk about games with about, present company included, about six people.
Yeah.
And excluding the present company, two of them are staff site members. Which means there's one person out there who's in the exception category, and that's the person mm-hmm. who gave me the Virtual Boy. So, I mean, it's a short list.
Yeah.
And I think that's fine. I mean, I know people who play, as we have been used the term a couple of times in this conversation, the quote, dude bro games, that I don't particularly have interest in, so I just don't talk about games with them. I mean, I don't need to. We have other yeah. things in common to talk about.
Yeah. But I mean, at the same time, I mean, my advice would be that don't let the attitudes of people around you close you off from certain genres of games or dismiss entire genres of games, because yeah. then you're yeah. no better than the people that are making fun of you because you like Nintendo games.
Yeah, I mean, if you think I've discussed 999 with people outside this podcast,
Herman Cain,
and a single staff member, and one, the two staff members that I regularly talk about games with, aside from my staff duties, I've only talked about it with one of them.
Again, mm-hmm. I think this is that the luxury that is the sort of indifference of adulthood. You know, yeah. it's just like when you're in school, there's all these people that are just crammed together. They really don't necessarily belong together, but they're forced together, and they're terribly intolerant people. At that age.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a sort of squashing of things that are different that goes on and all right. that kind of stuff. Yeah. Once you get older, it's like, well, they like something you don't like and vice versa, and no one gives a shit.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to bring up the games, obviously, if you don't think they're going to have a receptive audience to talk about them.
Yeah, but the other thing that you're forgetting as an adult is that children are nosy little fuckers. And they will ask you, it's like...
Greg fucking hates kids. That's the revelation of this podcast.
So, you know, if they're talking about Modern Warfare or whatever, and you're quiet, so well, what do you play then? You play kid shit then, do you?
Say, I play football, motherfucker.
It's yeah. an adult thing to say, well, yeah, I'm not going to ask him about it if he hasn't brought it up. That's an adult thing. Children do not yeah. need that invitation.
Yeah.
The reason adults don't understand children is because we've blocked out those portions of our memory yeah. because they were too traumatic.
I will say, though, that if you really want to impress your friends with your love of manly games for manly people, you should tell them you got Blackwater for Kinect. I don't give a fuck about any kind of crimes they committed. I am connecting out as Blackwater.
You could always turn around and start whipping their ass at Modern Warfare.
Is that like some sort of Karate Kid version?
Yeah. James, is there literally a Blackwater video game for Kinect?
Yes. Came out this week.
That is astounding.
Is it made by Blackwater as like a marketing tool?
It is licensed by Blackwater, yes.
That company's not even called Blackwater anymore. They changed their name because it was so bad PR.
XE, yes. I saw that press release.
It's now called Treadstone.
I saw that press release and almost died. I was like, what? Holy crap!
It's now called Datadyne.
There we go.
All right. Joanna. Greg has the final email this week.
Yeah, Marty from Belfast writes, "Hey RFN crew, I've just finished enjoying your recent 64-centric episode, and your discussion of that system's tumultuous development and release got me thinking about Nintendo's next home console. Recent analysis from financial analyst Wedbush Morgan has cited Nintendo's reluctance to release information about the upcoming Wii U as one of the reasons why Nintendo is unlikely to meet its predicted earnings for the quarter ending September 30th.
And boy, did they.
We'll get to that, I think, momentarily. My first question is whether you believe this lack of information on Nintendo's next home console is the result of the hardware not yet being finalized, or are Nintendo simply seeking to maximize their resources by focusing on the 3DS this holiday season? And secondly, which do you believe represents the most financially detrimental thing to the company at this time? The lackluster sales of their current home console, or their reluctance to provide details on its successor?"
So actually, the biggest contributor to their hard times is the fact that the yen is actually not in the shitter compared to everything else.
Yeah, and 3DS games as well. The 3DS game library has
hurt them. But I mean, if you, I mean, I helped write the story regarding the losses that came out.
Yeah,
this week.
I know that's their spin on it, though. Like that's, of course, that's a factor, it's, but
they always say that
it's bad.
But yeah, but this particular, the past quarter especially, but certainly extending even to this first 6 months of the current fiscal year, we've had the twin debt crises of America and Europe, which has meant that their currencies continue to lose value against the yen, which means that the markets where they draw the vast majority of their sales, that money they get from them is worth less to them in Japan.
Fair enough, but global currency issues are just, I can't stand to talk about them. So if that may very well be the primary factor.
No, I mean, it's a 52.4 billion yen issue in the last 6 months for them.
Okay, fair enough.
That is a big fucking number.
But John has it right. I looked at the report too, and the drastic cut in their 3DS software sales is astonishing.
It is. I mean,
the shortfall in what they thought they could sell.
Yeah. They might end up doing okay on hardware with the price cut, but they're so far behind on software. I mean, the tie ratio is miserable.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's with the price cut, I think it's dipped below 3 now, I think, is that ratio. But the point I wanted to make initially is, of course, what did Wed Bush Morgan actually say? What they said was that in addition to the fact that Nintendo is likely to miss its earnings projections for the most recent quarter, which of course they did, as we just described, on top of that, the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty about the next console will exacerbate the impact that has on their share price. They're not actually earning less money because people don't know about a console, obviously.
Yeah, because I was about to say that makes no sense.
Yeah, the point, I'm sure this is what Marty was getting at, is the fact that you have your compound effect for people who are looking to invest in Nintendo of like, well, they're earning less money now and we don't really know what they're going to be earning in the future because this console is kind of up in the air, you know, the details are sparse, so, you know, does that give you the confidence to invest in them? Not really. So it kind of affects the share price too. But since we've started, we may as well go through a bit more on what's happened with this earning situation, because it's historic stuff. They're basically now, they've posted losses in quarters before. I think they actually posted a loss over the first half of the last fiscal year. The same period in 2010. But of course, Nintendo, as you might expect, are a company that makes a hugely disproportionate amount of its money during the holiday period.
Yes.
And so what happened was, is they had those 6 months, they lost some money, and then because of Christmas, Thanksgiving, all that stuff around the world as well, you know, it's big, they made that back.
Yep.
Somewhat also boosted by cramming the 3DS right in at the end of that fiscal year, they were able to post a profit. This year, the losses at this point are so bad, exacerbated by the currency situation, that they are not going to make up the difference. And they are actually going to post a loss over the entire duration of the fiscal year, which is the first time they've done that since they've been in the console business.
And to be fair, that's the company's forecast, so...
Yeah.
They could have far better than expected sales this holiday season, but...
The problem is, every time they've been missing their forecast recently, it's been in the negative direction. Their forecasts have a track record of being a bit rosy. Admittedly, the results that we've just seen are not actually as bad as some of the advance reporting suggested it might be from the Nikkei. So actually, it was closer to Nintendo's estimates than people thought, but it was still worse than their estimates. So that's the kind of track record we're dealing with right now. But with the 3DS, though, I wanted to mention the fact in Japan, the price cut seems to have had its intended effect from the point of view that sales have more than doubled on a weekly, but they're selling about 50,000 units a week now, more than that. You have some weeks where there's a particular game, it spikes higher, but it's selling consistently about that level, about twice that of the PSP now. So that's much better than it was before when the PSP was still right there or selling more. But if you look at the software charts, there is virtually nothing in the top 20.
Right.
Sometimes a game will come along, like that booby game, the Senran Kagura or whatever, that came out.
It sells well for
a week, and then it goes out. You know, Zelda's ticking along there somewhere, like number 19.
Well, they don't have any mainstream hits. That's the thing.
They acknowledge that in their statement. They basically say, yeah, we don't have, they literally say that there is a lack of, quote, major games on the 3DS.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't even spin it anymore.
No, of course not. But this is the thing. I mean, so you've got this situation where even in Japan, where, you know, you have got more third-party games, you've got a certain amount of games that are, you know, ahead of where we are because of localization, like Tales of the Abyss or things that, you know, even there, they're so lagging so far behind on software compared to hardware. And the other thing that's interesting is, if you look at the numbers, what's happened as well is some of that increase in sales could be quite directly attributed to cannibalization of DSi and DSiX. XL or DSi LL, as it's called there, the DS Elite, because basically it's come down in price so far that it's like, well, you know, you may as well buy the 3DS, mightn't you, if you were in the market for a DS, simply. You're like, well, may as well buy it. It's backwards compatible and it's going to play these new games, 3D, etc. And if it's not more expensive, then why not? So the problem is there is that they've essentially cannibalized sales on hardware that would have made them a profit to sales on hardware that's making them a loss. And they're not yet selling the games to make up that shortfall. So it's no surprise at all that this quarter has been as bad as it's been in terms of losing money, because even, you know, to an extent that they made a move and it worked, it's costing them money in the short term, and that investment is not going to begin to be repaid until they start selling millions of copies of 3D Land, Mario Kart 7, etc.
For the first 6 months, they have Nintendo lost 70 billion yen, and for reference, it's 77 yen to the dollar. So basically about $900 million.
Yeah, nearly $1 billion, which is coincidentally about as much money as they made in the whole of the fiscal year before. So in 6 months, they've wiped out everything they made from last year.
Wow.
And to be fair, they're developing a new console now, so they're probably spending a lot on R&D. And
well, they said their R&D was actually flat, roughly.
Yep.
But it's worth mentioning as well, of course, that, you know, they've been in positions with consoles that have been in third place, and while they're developing a new one and this, that, and the other, and they've still been making a profit, because, you know, over the whole year anyway, because as you said, this has not happened while they've been in the console business. So this is different, and a lot of it is to do with the fact that they projected so wrong. They thought the 3DS was going to sell more in terms of software. They thought it was going to sell more at its original price. And also, Wii and DS software sales as well. I mean, they're still selling quite a lot of games, but they're still far short of their projections. So, of course, if they planned all their expenditures around those projections, they're falling so far short, this is what happens. So some of it, you have to say, is their predictive ability is somewhat worse than it's been in the past.
Well, so for reference, they had predicted back in July, so mind you, this was already when they were well underway into this six-month time frame, they were going to lose $35 billion, so half the amount they lost. Which means in July, they still had no firm grasp of what the situation really looked like.
Mm-hmm. That's where the currency probably comes in even more, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for reference, they missed the yen by about 3 yen on the dollar and about 8 yen on the euro or something along those lines. So it may not seem like a lot, but if you multiply the fact that 79% of their business happens in markets that don't use the yen, it's kind of, imagine if you had to give away 5 cents for every dollar you got. It's going to add up.
Well, to bring it back to games, point one, Japan is in a really good situation for 3D software sales this holiday season, because not only do they have Mario Kart and Super Mario. Is Animal Crossing coming out before the end of the year? Or is that early next year?
No, I don't think so. But obviously, Monster Hunter is the big.
Yeah, they have Monster Hunter and Resident Evil, both coming out in December. They are golden. Okay, they're going to sell bajillions of 3DS games this holiday season in Japan.
Yeah, and I mean, clearly, I think in addition to those, say, unit sales that are kind of, you could say, a cannibalizing DS unit sales, a lot of them are in anticipation of what is going to come out. I think clearly, you know, people are being sold on the fact that, you know, there is a Monster Hunter Tri-G coming, and then eventually a 4 coming. So,
well, I mean, it's essentially, I'm one of those people. Yeah. You know, I bought a 3DS in anticipation of what was coming out much later in the year, and I'm still waiting. But the other thing is, I mean, to get back to the question itself, it was about, is Nintendo's withholding of Wii U information hurting them right now? That's one analyst speculation, that it's hurting the share price, and maybe it is. But the thing is, we found out this week that Rockstar and Take-Two are going to announce GTA 5 next week.
Right.
And the announcement of the announcement caused their stock prices to jump way up. Well, that's because their investors expect really good things out of GTA 5. They
yes.
expect that the
yeah.
announcement will create a ton of hype, and that the game will sell even better than GTA 4, which was a tremendous success. The problem for Nintendo right now is that if they did come out tomorrow and announce some stuff about Wii U, I think their investors feel like it may not actually be what they want to hear. So the trepidation there is not that there's not enough information. It's that we don't generally feel like the Wii U is a surefire hit.
Yep.
So we don't, you know, they don't want Nintendo. I don't think they really want Nintendo to announce anything new about Wii U until they have confidence that it's going to be something that will get everybody really excited and will be unilaterally a good thing.
I'm reading their financial briefing that I guess just happened, the Iwata event. It seems like the next time they're going to show the final form of Wii U is going to be at E3.
Seems logical.
The exact quote is, "We would like to show you the final form of the Wii U at E3 next year. As we learned a bitter lesson with the launch of the Nintendo 3DS, we are trying to take every possible measure so that the Wii U will have a successful launch." That is a quote from the man himself.
Yeah, that's something we've thought about before, that could mean that they're not going to try and rush it to fit it into some sort of accounting deadline. You know,
right.
They are going to be more cautious. And therefore, they might well hold information back for longer, which may create more of a climate of uncertainty. But I suppose, I mean, if you want to track this back, really, you could say the problem could be with some of the missteps you might say they made in the presentation at the last E3.
Yeah.
That, you know, they communicated it in not the best way, you know, with the name. We've talked about that before. You know, the not differentiating it enough from the current, where this is actually a whole new platform and all this sort of stuff. Of course, not also having real kind of games to show with it, you know, some tech demos and, you know, games that are already on PS3 and the 360 and stuff like that is not the best way. So all those things is kind of like, you know, as you kind of alluded to, Johnny, you know, people are like, well, what we know isn't that reassuring. So do we want to know more? I think Nintendo now are just going to have to kind of accept that gloom and then wait until they've got the big sort of salvo at E3 next year and hope that that pierces the gloom and then everyone could kind of rally behind it. I mean, you know, it wasn't so different with the Wii last time. You know, obviously they've been intentionally vague for a long time. And
they had a lot to prove with Wii.
A great deal to prove.
Coming from behind.
They hadn't done a great job controlling information. Some of the things that got out about how similar it would be to GameCube, that wasn't that well handled. Yeah, that created a lot of climate of skepticism.
Well, they did it themselves.
But that created a climate of skepticism that ultimately they were able to shatter with strong showings and good messaging when it came to, you know, the E3 before it came out. So they could still pull off that kind of turnaround.
Sure.
The question, of course, is whether they are going to have their house in order by that time.
Yeah. Well, you always have to look at the source of these comments. I mean, these are coming from people who don't like risk, who have other people's money.
But at the same time, Nintendo must have been a terribly attractive investment for risk-averse people to have been in business as long as they have and so seldom posted a loss.
And that's what's so bizarre about it. Because, I mean, they take these huge hits. It's like, guys, they're going to post a profit this year. Why are you bailing?
Yeah.
And the reality is, I think they basically wrote it and they said, all right, this is the top. We're getting out. And you have to understand, investors aren't motivated by what they think the company is going to do in the long term. They're motivated by making their money right now.
These are not people who have their Nintendo stock framed up on the wall.
No.
They don't care about Nintendo. They care about making their money and then shifting it somewhere else.
They think they're on the top floor of the elevator, so it's time to get off. And I would say that, remember, when the Wii U was shown this year, and it was well received by the media who were present, and even by the analysts who were present, that the stock did not do well.
No, and in fact, but I mean, on the same tip from gamers, you know, those of us who actually got to hold it and play it, we're fairly satisfied with the promise of what it's going to be. A lot of gamers at home watching this were really concerned, you know, and I understand why, because playing is believing or whatever. But, you know, I'm really looking forward to Wii U. But if I was a Nintendo stockholder, I would be concerned too, because I think there is a lot of uncertainty right now as to whether the Wii U will be able to replicate or even approach the success of Wii. And that's right. What they want, right? They bought this stock because it was rising like crazy, and you know, the Wii was tremendously successful around the world, and they expect Nintendo to repeat that success, and it may just be impossible.
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
They're going to be disappointed no matter what, and they're waiting for Nintendo to show something about this system that gives them some confidence that it's going to be a slam dunk, and it may not happen.
Well, that's the thing. I think part of the problem also is the fact that I don't think that people can still really put a finger on exactly what made the Wii so popular. Mm. You know, it's not like something like GTA 5. You can pretty much figure out why that's popular, and you can pretty much say, hey, if they make the same thing again, it'll be popular like that again. But if they made the Wii again...
Well, yeah, I mean, one is a creative product, and the other is a piece of metal, so...
Well, John's pretty figure on why so many game series are in the current gaming market, you know, annualized and you know, those certain features are sort of, you know, because that's what companies at the top level understand.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
But you can't sequelize a console and guarantee success. Look at PlayStation 3.
Yeah, it's like saying, like something like Minecraft. Asking that company to do that again as a stockholder?
Minecraft 2. They haven't even finished the first one, John. Don't get ahead of yourself.
I'm just saying, like, you can't, like, that stuff does not come out of a bottle.
The timing and certain organic factors that you can't just replicate, and obviously the surrounding environment changes a great deal in the interim. So, I mean, there's many reasons for people to be trepidatious about Nintendo's prospects in the console market the next time around. And I honestly don't think that there's much that they could say now to reassure them. So it is going to have to wait until E3, and you know, they're going to have to perhaps do a better job of, you know, selling both the people in the room and the people on the outside with some better messaging. But ultimately, you know, there's only so much they could do in that regard. The proof, as ever, it being in the pudding, is going to be, you know, how it performs once it gets in the marketplace.
Well, I mean, if only they did all their business in yen like that one investor had suggested, then they'd be fine.
Well, you know, I think it's going to be really tricky for them, even at E3, and I think it may behoove them to actually announce some things about Wii U before E3, maybe, you know, split the difference and do it in March or so when they have all their, you know, end of fiscal year stuff, because it's going to be hard for them to keep the spotlight at E3, because there's a very high likelihood that Microsoft and Sony will both announce new hardware at E3. It may not come out next year. In fact, it probably won't come out in 2012.
No, Microsoft's is already pretty much confirmed to not be in the next year.
Yeah, but they will probably announce it to some
degree.
They can talk about it, but the Wii U will be there. I mean, that's going to be the difference.
I understand it's different, but for investors, they look at these things a little differently.
I mean, I think some of the willingness to talk about it, in terms of what you, I mean, it's an important reference point that you brought up there, Johnny, which is, of course, the end of this current fiscal year, when that ends in March of the next calendar year. Their willingness to maybe talk about Wii U might be dependent on just how well or not the 3DS has fared in that time. In the sense that if they're able to sort of mitigate their losses to a very high extent and end up with a sort of modest loss because the 3DS does really well in the holiday season and they sell loads of games to go with it, finally, then maybe they'd be content to say, look, you know, for now, what we're doing is concentrate on carrying forward the momentum of the 3DS and, you know, we'll talk about the Wii U at E3.
Right.
But if it's not so rosy, and the 3DS is still looking like a bit of a problem child in Nintendo's sort of hardware lineup, then maybe they'd be more keen to sort of redirect the conversation to, like, well,
we've got the Wii U on the horizon, and here's a little bit of something to get excited about from an investor's point of view, about why this could be a game changer, let's say, if they're still looking a bit grim. So I think if things all go according to plan, and the 3DS does have the big holiday season they're hoping for, then it will wait till E3. Otherwise, the plan B could be to try and get the train rolling a bit quicker.
And it's worth noting that it's not company vital that the investors be happy right away.
Yeah, well, as we've mentioned before, during the 3DS price cut situation,
they've got a fuck ton of cash.
Yes, they are sitting on a lot of cash and liquid assets that mean that they are not dependent on, you know, new investors or something like a stock issue or something to raise money to get them through a period. You know, that could last them a good while. So yes, they need not be so beholden. But at the same time, they do make these sort of political gestures, you know, like Iwata cutting his salary in half or whatever. I mean, that is a political gesture to the investors.
He's already very low salary in half, to be
fair.
That
is not a materially significant cost containment move, halving his salary.
No, he's making it up on the speaker circuit.
There you go. Telling people about downloadable games.
So just to clarify my E3 thing once again before we wrap up here, I do think that the other consoles will be a topic to some degree. And obviously Wii U will be much more material at E3 2012, you know, and it will be coming out relatively soon afterward. And that is, I'm not glazing over that, but all three systems, I believe, will exist in some fashion at the show, whether ethereally or not. And the key for Nintendo is to make people believe that Wii U is the future of gaming. And depending on whatever Microsoft and Sony come up with, I don't know what it will be, but they may challenge that, even if it turns out to not even be true. You know, like even if they sort of sell the idea of their next system as doing something that it won't really do. But from an investor's point of view, you want to see, well, you know, Wii U may be a totally solid console and it may sell 50 million units, but it's not going to be the future of gaming like Wii was in 2006. So that's what they're going to be looking for. And, you know, it's going to be an interesting challenge for Nintendo to prove that, especially since they can't make promises that they don't keep because the system's coming out right after E3, you know, relatively speaking.
No, but at the same time, they can put the system in the hands of investors and give them those one-on-ones that we see them
leaving. They can, but don't you think bullshitting is the much more valuable asset at this stage of the game?
Well, no, because I think to an extent, you run into investors being terrified of something they don't know
as
well.
Terrified of the unknown.
And even if the Wii U, which I don't think it will, I think the Wii U will probably be a fairly successful system, but even if it just bombs, and the 3DS bombs, and Nintendo goes into this 3-year cycle where they're going, oh God, we just have to live off our cash. The stock price today is still totally irrelevant.
Well, it's relevant in the sense that it changes Hiroshi Yamauchi's position on Japan's richest man list.
That's
which
true.
I don't know how much that feeds through to policy anymore, but it might be non-trivial.
He might have to remove Iwata, is that what you're saying?
All right, on that silly note, why don't we wrap it up? Folks, you just heard a conversation that you could only hear on Radio Free Nintendo, and you can hear more topics like that and more crazy niche discussions on things that only a few people care about.
The difference of 3 yen to the dollar affecting a multinational corporation.
Yeah, this is why we're not on MTV, guys.
Yeah, this is the reason.
So you can feed the fire of our insanity about Nintendo by sending your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We would really appreciate it. And there's actually a link to a contact form where you can write an email on the website if you don't want to type in the email address or if you can't remember it. Surprisingly, people can't remember it, even though I say it about 3 times every show. But you can always go to the show notes on the website over at NintendoWorldReport.com. There's a link to the email form. You can type it up in there. And we do get a fair number of emails through that method, actually, so I know people use it. And there will also be a link to the retroactive forum thread where you can leave your thoughts on River City Ransom. We will be talking about it next week. Again, it's 500 points on the Wii Shop channel. It is very easy to get. It's very affordable, and it's a fun little game. I think you should check it out and let us know what you think. leave a post in the forum. We will be reading people's posts on the air next week and discussing those along with our own thoughts on the game. So another announcement I have is that just in a few weeks from now, we're going to be having our second annual NWR Live podcast for Child's Play.
Yeah.
This was a really big hit last year, and we raised a lot of money for a very good charity, and we did a 7.5-hour podcast, as I recall, I think, or no, 6.5. I don't know. I lost count because it was so long.
6.5, I believe. Huh?
It was long, and things happened, and yeah.
Yes, we had special guests. We had participation from a wide swath of the staff and had a really good time. We also had a lot of really cool listener interaction. We had people calling in and talking to us, just like on the 250th anniversary show. Well, it wasn't the 250th anniversary. It was the 5th anniversary.
250 years we've been doing this.
Only you, John.
Sometimes it feels like it.
To you?
Regardless, we're going to do another big live show live, and we want you to be there. So please mark your calendar right now for Saturday, November 19th. It is the Saturday before Thanksgiving, and that means we'll be talking about Zelda and a lot of other crazy stuff happening around that time. We'll have, I think Mario 3D Land will be out around then. So
yeah.
It's going to be really cool. We are planning a lot of stuff behind the scenes. I might have more details to announce next week, but things are coming together. We're lining up guests. We're planning content. We're doing everything we can to make this really awesome so that you will want to listen and that you will want to donate. It will work a little bit differently than last year in that the amount of donations we're looking to get will be constant throughout the day. So each hour of additional podcasting will cost just as much as the one before it. So hopefully that won't make it feel increasingly difficult to keep things going. It'll be a little bit more natural result. So we plan to be on the air for quite a long time, and that in order to do that, we need your support. If you go over to the website, NintendoWorldReport.com, there will be a page with the details. It may be a little minimal at this moment. It will get more and more and more updated as we get closer. We'll have more information and more stuff. But at the very least, there will be a donation box on there. Now you can go ahead and donate, and anything you donate between now and November 19th will count towards the total. And actually, we would really appreciate that because it helps us sort of get an idea of just how long we're going to be on the air. But of course, we will be asking people to donate during the live show as well. I think whatever you can contribute, you will find that your money was very well spent, not only because we're producing this ridiculous live podcast thing for you to listen to and enjoy, but also because it goes to a great cause, and that would be the Child's Play charity that buys toys for sick kids in hospitals, actually around the world now. It's not even just American, it's all over the world. So it's a really, really good organization, and we enjoy supporting it, and it gives us an excuse to do ridiculous things like podcast for 6.5 hours and talk about Nintendo. So yes, it will be awesome, and we appreciate your support for that. I think that's it. Time to wrap it up. We'll see you next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Oh, now playing.
John, do this one as John Madden.
I don't know if I can do John Madden.
Billy does a great, great Madden.
Wow, heck of a play! I don't know if I can do the whole thing.
That's video game John Madden, the real one.
yeah.
He's like really muffled through the Genesis.